the podcast.
Have you ever been in a bookshop browsing and noticed you're drawn to books with similar titles or jacket art? It's not something I'd really picked up on before, until Canadian writer Emily St. John Mandel pointed out that there are some trends in publishing that are more pervasive than you might have realised. Her essay with audio infographics in a moment.
1993, 12, 1996, 21, 2001, 27, 2003, 32, 2009, 43, 2011, 57.
Also, a British expat's family gets to experience a true Aussie Christmas.
It's nice, it is, but it's not really Christmas, is it? It's all flip-flops and barbecue skewers from where I'm standing.
And finally, three little words calling for a life-changing response.
Egg donor needed.
This is the Radiotonic Podcast with me, Jesse Cox. Stay listening. Trends come and go in publishing, and it's certainly true for the titles of novels. Canadian writer Emily St. John Mandel noticed a large number of books following the formula, The So-and-So's Daughter. Determined to get to the bottom of what she thought might be the most popular trend in book naming, Emily sat down at her desk, opened a spreadsheet, and started counting.
Titles have a way of coming in waves. There was a time a few years back when it seemed like vast numbers of books were being published on the subject of secret lives. The secret life of bees, the secret lives of buildings, the secret life of words, and so on. Our literature seems to hold a parallel obsession with vanishing, which involves, of course, any number of titles involving the words disappear, or vanishing, or lost. But no trend has seemed quite so pervasive as the daughter phenomenon. Seriously, once you start noticing them, they're everywhere. I'm Facebook friends with the authors of The Hummingbird's Daughter, The Baker's Daughter, The Calligrapher's Daughter, and The Murderer's Daughters. And those are just the ones I can think of off the top of my head. I was curious to see how many of these books there actually are. So I did a search for books with the and daughter in their titles. I spent some time copying and pasting all instances of the fill-in-the-blank's daughter into a spreadsheet. How much time? A lot, because I'm studying a foreign language. And cutting and pasting text is exactly the kind of mindless activity that can be done while I'm listening to language podcasts.
Bienvenido a la clase de español. La hija del taxista. The taxi driver's daughter.
The number of the fill-in-the-blank's daughter books out there is truly staggering. By the time I stopped copying and pasting, I was left with 530 titles. 530 was just the arbitrary point where I decided to stop counting, because the project was starting to take too much time. To be clear, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with calling one's book the fill-in-the-blank's daughter. I think those titles have a marvelous rhythm to them. And yet I couldn't help but wonder why there seemed to be so many. I turned, as I like to do whenever a publishing-related question arises, to the booksellers. Partly because I know a lot of independent booksellers, and they're some of my favorite people. And partly because I've noticed that they're much more outspoken about publishing than most people in publishing are. It's a refreshing quality. I spoke with the manager of Word, a popular bookshop in New York City. I was curious if the fill-in-the-blank's daughter books sell better than other titles, or if there was any other advantage she could think of. Her theory, she told me, was that familiar-sounding titles drive sales because they help give readers a small feeling of comfort when they're contemplating which book to purchase out of the thousands and thousands available. She suggested perhaps repeated words like daughter give an overwhelmed person standing in front of a new fiction table a place to start. And it goes double for the books with The Empty Shoes and The Headless Girls in Sundresses on the cover. If you've had a good experience with one in the past, it makes sense to try something similar on your next trip. She's right, I realized. There are an awful lot of headless girls in sundresses on the covers of contemporary fiction, although I hadn't noticed The Empty Shoes. What I found fascinating was she said she'd never had a customer mix up the daughters in these books' titles. Apparently, no one comes into the store looking for The Apothecary's Daughter when they mean The Apostate's Daughter. Perhaps, then, there's something about the rhythm and construction of these titles which aids memory, which means that naming your book The Daughter is a very sensible thing to do. Perhaps the construction is so familiar that the average reader, having seen dozens or even hundreds of these titles, only really has to remember one word. Perhaps at a certain point, the mind plugs in the and daughter automatically. There seems to be a steady trickle of these titles in every decade, from the early 1900s through the present day. But my extremely unscientific and incomplete data suggests that it's a growing trend. Just because a given set of data is wildly unscientific and woefully incomplete, does that mean it shouldn't be graphed? No, it does not. I sorted my list of 530 titles by date and fired up PowerPoint.
1996. 1991.
7.
1992.
12.
1993.
12.
1996.
21.
2001.
27.
2003.
32.
2009.
43.
2011.
57.
I was curious to see if women were more likely to end up with the daughter books than men, either because they chose the title themselves or because their editors chose the title for them. This called for a pie chart.
Female.
387.
Male.
127.
Unknown.
16.
What I found the most startling, aside from the sheer numbers, was the range of occupations, people, crimes, social classes, mythologies, and attributes represented in these titles. I'm familiar with the General's Daughter, but the Martian General's Daughter was new to me. The identity of these daughters' parents ranged from the relatively mundane, the taxi driver's daughter, to the wildly unexpected, the Eiffel Tower's daughter. When I looked over the list, certain patterns began to emerge. I started grouping titles into categories. Some categories, academics, servants, cartographers, explorers, and political activists, turned out to be quite small, just a handful of titles in each. On the other hand, the daughters of artists and artisans, painters, lace makers, musicians, calligraphers, were particularly well represented. As were the daughters of people connected to royalty, dukes, kings, and magical and/or supernatural entities, devils, centaurs, demons. A great many parents represented on the list are politicians. The senator's daughter, the governor's daughter, or involved in the church, the bishop's daughter, the vicar's daughter. There are, in fact, several vicar's daughters. Prevailing trends in jacket art suggest that they're especially fond of low-cut blouses. But that's neither here nor there. Then there's a large group of parents who are villainous and or on the wrong side of the law. The outlaw's daughter. The killer's daughter. Followed by a group employed as laborers. The miner's daughter. And a group that's affiliated with the military. The admiral's daughter. The colonel's daughter. A lot of them work with animals. The rancher's daughter. Are possibly metaphorical. The son's daughter. Work in medicine. The emergency doctor's daughter.
Stand clear.
Or are employed in retail. The merchant's daughter. The retailers are followed by three groups of exactly the same size. Parents who do pseudo-sciencey things like astrology. I'll let you guess those titles. Parents in law enforcement or the judiciary. It's daughter. And parents who are keepers of either inns or lighthouses. The last significant group involves parents who, to put the matter as delicately as possible, probably weren't married when their daughter was conceived. The harlot's daughter. The mistress's daughter. But in case you missed some of those titles, I made a graph for this, too.
Involved with the church.
7. They work with animals.
1.
They
two,
do pseudo-sciencey
four,
things
six,
like astrology
12,
and alchemy.
21, 43, 32,
keepers
of inns or lighthouses.
21, 12, 43.
Possibly metaphorical.
The Z Daughter was written and read by Emily St. John Mandel, with original sound and music by Russell Stapledon. It was adapted from an essay first published in The Millions, a weblog about books. And the story was performed live for our Storytelling with Sound event at the Sydney Writers' Festival just a couple of weeks ago. You can see pictures from that event, as well as the graphs in all their PowerPoint glory online. And did we miss a particular The Z Daughter title? Leave us a comment about that, or jacket art, or publishing trends you've noticed. abc.net.au/rn/radiotonic.
So what is a radiotonic?
This is the Radiotonic Podcast with me, Jesse Cox. Writer Phil Spencer's father, Alan, has seen his fair share of the world. As an ex-military man, he survived armed combat across the globe, camping in deserts and living in war zones in multiple countries. But nothing prepared him for a sunny Christmas in Summer Bay.
How come I never believe you blokes when you start using the word honest? You got deliveries today, the Savo, too?
Yes, sir.
Because I got knackered at the store.
Well, it's my day off from working, that's not fair.
My father, Alan, has been a friendly but uncompromising man for 50-odd years, 30 of which were spent in Her Majesty's Royal Air Force, though royal it was not. Alan is a handsome, stern-looking man with a strong nose, thin, greying hair and eyelids that are bagged by years of not quite sleeping the full eight. Since he was 13, my dad smoked 40 fags a day and routinely devoured handfuls of extra-strong mints, which left his breath offensively fresh. He quit smoking a few years back, but still, whenever I think of my dad, I just see a forearm resting out of the window of his beloved white Ford Sierra, a lit silk cut gently ashing onto the tarmac below. But my mum never really worried too much about his smoking, because it was the 1980s and, you know, lung cancer hadn't been invented yet.
Rage. He's dead.
Even on a good day, it wouldn't be unfair to describe my dad as grumpy. He's just one of those humans whose default expression is a bit glum. That's his thing. Even on his surprise 50th birthday, with all his family around him, when he swears he's having a good time, his frowned forehead betrays his happiness. And we tease him about it.
Piss off, he'd say. I'm having fun. This is me fun face. Look, I'm bloody smiling you lot, so bugger off.
My dad's voice, even at its most loving and softly spoken, still possesses a sagittorial manner that rings in your ears long after you've put the phone down. Now, thinking back, I'm pretty certain that we never went on a family holiday. In part due to my dad's deployments. He seemed to spend my entire childhood being dragged over to Cyprus, the Falklands, Norway, and he even served in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it wasn't until I, at 25, moved to the Antipodes with my now wife that we actually went on holiday together. My mum and dad saved up and came to spend Christmas with us here in Sydney. Or, as my dad remarked,
"It's nice, it is, but it's not really Christmas, is it? It's all flip-flops and barbecue skewers from where I'm standing."
So we decided to take them to Palm Beach on Christmas Day and fully embrace the Australian Yuletide experience. On the drive there, my dad kept saying, "Summer Bay, eh? Bloody Summer Bay." And without enough irony in his voice to assure me as to whether he was being serious or not, "Do you think Alf will open up on Christmas Day? Or will he close the diner and stay home?" To which my mum shakes her head in familiar disapproval. We park the car and set up our festive camp on an almost empty stretch of sand beneath an overcast sky. And we are armed with hats, shirts and enough sunscreen to drown a British tourist. As we unfold our chairs and lay down our towels, my mum, Big Sue, although she does prefer just Sue, turns to my dad and innocently inquires, "Have you got enough sunscreen on, Alan?"
"Don't."
"What? my mum replies. Don't treat me like a bloody child, Sue. I've seen more of the world than you care to remember. Yes, but the sun is very strong here, Alan.
Strong, is it? Sue, don't patronise me. I know about extremes. I've lived in a tent in the sub-Saharan desert, Sue. I've been involved in armed combat in 50-degree heat, Sue. I think I can handle a day on a bloody beach in the land of Oz, don't you? I'll be fine. Now, who wants an ice cream? I'm going to go and see if Alf's opened up or not.
And my dad turned and clambered up the sandy beach with all the grace of an expat on the hunt for a gay time. As in, the ice cream. We all sit back beneath sun rollies with my dad's words still ringing in our ears. I'll be fine. And he was fine. He was absolutely fine all day. He was fine as we packed the car, and he was still fine when we drove home. He was fine as we ate dinner, and he was fine as we played the obligatory game of Christmas charades. He was fine as we drank port and ate cheese. He was fine as we settled in for our annual father-son argument, in which my dad proposed that political correctness has gone mad. And I countered that claim by explaining that gollywogs were not really a cultural artefact I felt nostalgic about, and that, at best, I thought gollywogs were an odd and unnecessarily racist marketing idea to help with the selling of marmalade. He was fine when we agreed to disagree. He was fine as he washed his hair and brushed his teeth and readied himself for bed. But then suddenly, he wasn't fine. His face made a peculiar oblong shape and he shook his head, inquiring,
"Are anybody else's feet warm?"
We collectively looked down to see the tops of my father's feet. And he was not fine. Because his feet had turned the colour of a deep bruised beetroot and seemed to have a shimmer of carcinogenic red shrieking through an almost purple shell. No, he was certainly not fine. And I want to be clear, his feet were not sunburnt. They were third degree doctor surgery, couldn't walk for a fortnight slash rest of his holiday burnt. You know you're not fine when a medical practitioner's opening line is, "How close were you to the bonfire?" And by the morning, Alan had white, saucer-sized blisters resting atop his feet like two disgruntled jellyfish, violently shimmering in the morning light and threatening to pop at any moment. His feet looked like they'd been cut off, put over a Bunsen burner, and then stuck back on by someone who was not well-versed at doing that sort of thing. Alan couldn't walk and he couldn't wear shoes. And so from then on in, Alan's Australian adventures focused mostly on motels and hotel rooms, viewing Australia's many popular cultural icons with the aid of the internet. When you ask him about the majesty of the Blue Mountains or the beauty of the Southern Highlands, my dad draws on postcard memories. Actual postcards that my mum brought back for him. But Big Sue clearly had some superhuman powers. Because although Alan had essentially ruined the holiday of a lifetime, my mum never once said, "I told you so." Although, to be fair, for the rest of that fortnight, she did relish any opportunity to wield phrases like, "Would you like a glass of water, Alan? Or are you fine? How's the aircon? Too cold? Or are you fine? Do you want us to bring you back some kangaroo jerky, Alan? Or are you fine?" Ow!
One Fine Day was written and read by Phil Spencer, with sound by Russell Stapleton. Phil's next live comedy storytelling show, Glorious Pomegranate, will premiere at Giant Dwarf in mid-September as part of the Sydney Fringe Festival. Keep an ear out for that. And in the meantime, we're on Twitter at @RN_CAU, accepting all stories of sunburnt horror. This is the Radiotonic Podcast. I'm Jesse Cox. Finally today, we dive back into the classifieds. Over the past few weeks, journalist Fiona Harari has been picking out intriguing ads from the thousands of classifieds online and bringing you the stories behind them. Today's ad was just three little words.
Addendum. Stories behind the classifieds. Egg donor needed.
This is a story about love. It's an unlikely mix involving two newspaper ads, countless strangers, and some all-important timing that has helped one woman realise one dream while making it that much harder for her to achieve another. Penny Simmons is 48, self-sufficient, happily employed, and lives in Adelaide. And Penny is eager to have a child. 4 years ago, she started planning a new life as a single mother and began IVF treatments. Then she met the man of her dreams. Rob Chesler is 53. Penny met him online and could soon imagine the good life they would have together, the nice home filled with adored children. But they'd just met and wanted to know each other better before starting a family, so they decided to wait 6 months before trying. And when they did, their plans began to fall apart. Penny did not get pregnant. They considered IVF again, this time together, but then Penny was sick for several months, and by the time she was well enough to try IVF again, she discovered she had no eggs left to retrieve. It was too late. So she and Rob began the long search to find a stranger who would help them have a child, a search that's still ongoing today. It's ironic that if we'd met 10 years ago, I wouldn't have to be doing this, Penny says of their increasingly public search to find an egg donor, a quest with no obvious path. How do you find someone who's willing to provide one half of your child's DNA so that you can raise that child as your own? Penny and Rob began fairly close to home. Over a glass of wine one night, a friend of a friend was suggested, a lovely 23-year-old who'd already had 4 children of her own. She went through weeks of counselling and testing and seemed an ideal candidate until her eggs were retrieved and none of them worked, and she was no longer able to be their good Samaritan. So Penny and Rob turned to the classifieds to help start their family. Their ad was brief, especially by today's standards, which can run to multiple paragraphs. It really doesn't take much to say a lot. Sometimes 3 words are all you need. I love you. Get a life. Yes, we can. Penny and Rob's ad just said, egg donor needed. They included a mobile number and an email address, and then they waited. Tens of thousands of classifieds are published every day, so the chances of willing and suitable respondents reading this ad were always going to be slim. But no one really expected that one of the few people to call would be a journalist from the Adelaide Advertiser. Penny and Rob's ad was front page news soon after, but despite the unexpected publicity, it didn't bring them any closer to parenthood. So they placed a second ad and again lobbed their fate out to the universe. Several women contacted them, but few seemed to fit the brief, a non-smoker, aged 35 or under, and preferably a mother who planned to have no more children of her own. But even for the few who did match Penny and Rob's requirements, there was almost always another problem. One woman thought she might already be pregnant. Another potential donor had been considering self-harm. And there was the caller who kept putting off meetings until Penny figured if she couldn't even organise to catch up for a cuppa, how could she rely on her to contribute to her child's genetic makeup? One woman, though, did seem potentially wonderful. She was fit and healthy, warm and funny. She'd never had a child herself, but was happy to help this couple she only really knew over an introductory cup of coffee. But she'd planned some overseas travel and wouldn't be able to start right away. Of course, the process of treating a suitable donor takes months, and time has a way of running out, so who knows if she'll work out in the end. So Penny does what she can. She perseveres. She's written to several women photographed on a website of potential donors, but hasn't heard back from anyone so far. And there's a chance, she says, that laws might still change in South Australia and a donated egg could come from overseas, which would greatly expand the parameters of their search. Who knows? When love arrived comparatively late in Penny's life, she couldn't have been happier. Now she's just hoping for another miracle to bookend her fairy tale. As she says, we don't want for anything apart from a child.
Addendum. Stories behind the classifieds.
Fiona Harari. The sound engineer was Mark Don. If this is your first addendum, or you want to listen back to previous episodes, find the addendum series page on the right-hand side of our homepage, abc.net.au/rn/radiotonic. Two things before we go. We're once again collecting your short anecdotes, this time any stories that are spooky or supernaturally inspired. Email cau@abc.net.au with your tale in a sentence or two. Plus, sign up right now for our recently launched weekly email missive, CAU Happenings. It's the best way to stay up to date with everything we're doing at the Creative Audio Unit. You'll find links to sign up on our website. Next week, we're getting on with the show.
I bought a microphone once during the second act of a show on eBay, and every time I was about to confirm the bid, I had to play again, so I put the phone quickly down on the floor, and then when I picked it up again, I'd been automatically locked out, so I had to go back, and I think I was actually bidding against myself.
Now, I've been a drama critic for 4 decades, and that's a fairly accurate blanket statement. But here's the bad news. You don't have anywhere near that much time with the musical.
So what are you suggesting? I should just get on with the show then?
Yeah.
Join Joel Carnegie as he goes backstage on opening night to investigate the world of musical theatre and to find out what it takes to step into the spotlight. Technical production today by David LeMay. Radiotonic is brought to you by RN's Creative Audio Unit, the letters CAU, and the sound of. I'm Jesse Cox. Join me next time on the Radiotonic podcast.
This week on Future Tense, we take you to the 2015 Remix Summit in Sydney for a panel discussion entitled The Creative Revolution, exploring the transformation of content creation and distribution. What are the implications for culture? It's all about co-creation, audience engagement and monetization. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.